We have a mixed family, DACA recipients, those who weren't able to apply for DACA, U.S. citizens.
Instead of talking about how awesome of a celebration Juneteenth is, or how much more that needs to be done to address issues that are relevant to the African-American community, we're talking about Trump's presidential visit.
So the idea was for Texans to return to Mexico rather than returning to the United States of America in order to perpetuate some form of slavery.
Many of our ancestors that were here that did run ran to Mexico. So that's a history and a story that we don't hear about.
Welcome to COVID Race and Democracy, a special program brought to you by the Pacifica COVID Task Force, the Pacifica Network, and affiliate stations, and a host of volunteers and you, the community. June 19, 1865, marks the origin of the Juneteenth celebration that began on the island of Galveston. Actually, the celebration was held, the first one, in 1866 to commemorate freedom and liberation. We are indeed grateful to efforts led by many African Americans to mark this historic day, including the late state representative Al Edwards of Houston, Texas. Juneteenth became an official state holiday in Texas in 1980. We will hear more about the history and significance of Juneteenth. But first, the news.
These are the headlines for Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Lily Bolke. 155 years ago today, on June 19, 1865, Union soldiers arrived in Galveston, Texas, and read General Order No. 3 informing enslaved African Americans that they were free, 2.5 years after the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. Juneteenth has long been celebrated by Black Americans, and a growing number of states are finally making it an official holiday. Lisa Coleman, Senior Vice President for Global Inclusion and Strategic Innovation at New York University, moderated a panel last week called Blackness, Racism, and Protest Reflections on the Past, Present, and Future.
As we approach the commemorations of Juneteenth and its juxtaposition to the national holiday of July 4th, we are reminded of the long legacies of Black resistance, liberation movements, protests, riots, revolts, and resistance and resilience have existed simultaneously and have been multifaceted. Whether we go back to the Atlantic slave trade or on all the way today, these legacies of liberation and social transformation have been so part and such a part of the continual movements within Black communities.
Donald Trump is holding his first rally since COVID started tomorrow, not only the day after Juneteenth, but in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Pastor Robert Turner's church, the historic Vernon AME Church, is the only standing Black-owned structure in the Greenwood District from before white city residents burned down Black Wall Street, a thriving Black business community and residential area in 1921.
There's still devastation here. There's emotional trauma here. There's still been no justice given, no reparations. Instead of talking about how awesome of a celebration Juneteenth is, or how much more that needs to be done to address issues that are relevant to the African-American community, we're talking about Trump's presidential visit.
In the wake of the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, nationwide protests have been ongoing in New York City, Atlanta, Austin, Seattle, and more. They've been preceded and followed by countless instances of state violence against Black Americans. George Floyd's family and friends planned a George Floyd Juneteenth block party in Houston. The FBI is investigating the deaths of two Black men found hanging from trees in California, 24-year-old Robert Fuller in Palmdale last week, and 38-year-old Malcolm Harsh 10 days earlier in San Bernardino County. On Wednesday, Fuller's half-brother, Teron Jamal Boone, was shot and killed during an interaction with Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies, according to the family's lawyer. Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Dreamers, rejecting President Trump's attempt to repeal DACA, or deferred action for childhood arrivals. Maria Yepes is a DACA recipient and spoke at a press conference by the League of United Latin American Citizens.
We have a mixed family, DACA recipients, those who weren't able to apply for DACA, U.S. citizens. So definitely into this morning was not only like a win for myself, but like for my family as well. Seeing all the advocacy work that we have done is definitely paying off.
Andrea Flores, Deputy Director of Immigration Policy for the ACLU, credits the undocumented youth community who fought hard for this decision and says there's more work to be done, legislating permanent protections and creating a pathway to citizenship for all 11 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S.
And I think this decision also comes at a time when the movement for Black lives is forcing our country to look at our history of white supremacy, and we stand in solidarity with that movement with this moment. We know that our two movements are interconnected. And I think this is a really important day for racial justice. And I hope further adds to the momentum that combating white supremacy is something that connects our immigration policies and our policing policies. And they're all part of the same system that makes America imperfect for brown and black communities.
Finally, a free Yale University course on African American history is seeing renewed popularity. It includes lectures on different periods of Black history, as well as on Black historical figures Booker T. Washington, Ida B. Wells Barnett, W.E.B. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, Martin Luther King Jr., and Malcolm X. And those are the headlines in today's news. I'm Lily Bulkey from the Pacifica Affiliate Network.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt, your host from KPFT Houston. There is much to discover about the history of Juneteenth. Today, esteemed scholar and historian Dr. Gerald Horn is with us to share his research and uncover more facts about Juneteenth. The story is much more complicated than we know. Here's Dr. Horn.
Dr. Horn, there is a known history of Juneteenth. Most of us understand that General Granger came to the shores of Galveston and declared African people free, captives free. And this was 2 years after the actual proclamation. And June 19th, 1865, on the shores of Galveston. However, you're saying that this story or this mythology is really not an accurate description of exactly what happened.
Well, that's correct. And let me first of all say that I support the idea of marking Juneteenth, June 19th, as a day when we commemorate the bondage, the slavery of people of African descent in the current borders of the United States of America. Let me also say that I'm in the process of writing a larger book that incorporates what I'm about to tell you, so people can keep an eye out for that when it'll probably be published next year. But let me say that in order to understand Juneteenth, you have to understand that Texas was the state in the so-called Confederate States of America that seceded from the United States in order to have slavery forevermore, that was probably least damaged by the Lincoln government army during the course of the U.S. Civil War, 1861 to 1865. And so what happens after Robert E. Lee, the commander of the Confederate troops, surrenders in April 1865, and as you know, during that same month, Mr. Lincoln himself was assassinated, is that the Confederate Texans had this idea that they were going to fight on. And as we know, when you had the rising of the Ku Klux Klan after the end of the Civil War, that was just a further emblem of the Confederates deciding to fight on. But what happened simultaneously during the U.S. Civil War is that the French had taken over Mexico, and the French were very friendly to the Confederate States of America. So the idea was for Texas, which had seceded from Mexico in 1836 because Mexico had moved toward abolition of slavery in the 1820s under a president of African and indigenous descent, speaking of Vicente Guerrero. So the idea was for Texas to return to Mexico rather than returning to the United States of America in order to perpetuate some form of slavery. And so when General Granger showed up, it wasn't necessarily that the Africans didn't know about the Emancipation Proclamation. The idea was is that their so-called masters were going to try to continue a form of bondage, but that particular project was foiled for various reasons. Number one, the people of Mexico rose up as one against the French puppet leader, Maximilian, and within 2 years, that is to say by 1867, had kicked him out of office and had made sure that he was basically executed. And then simultaneously, there were a number of black troops who were part of the U.S. military who sided with the Mexicans in terms of trying to get rid of Maximilian. And that foiled the attempt for Texas to return to the embrace of French-ruled Mexico. And therefore, Texas had to return to the Union, to the United States of America. Now, we also know that Texas returning to the United States of America did not necessarily mean that they dropped their idea of seeking to sabotage the United States of America and seeking to implant a form of neo-slavery on black people, which, of course, is what preceded, not only in terms of the convict lease system, where black people would be arrested on a flimsy pretext and then hired out to various plantations and farms to work for next to nothing in a kind of neo-slavery. And there are other forms of this kind of neo-slavery, too, that unfolded not only in Texas, but throughout Dixie. So in sum and in short, that's the interpretation of Juneteenth that I'll be presenting in this book.
You were listening to Dr. Gerald Horn, Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. You're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. When captured Africans were held against their will for nearly 400 years in the United States, music was a source of escaping the brutal impact of being enslaved in a strange land with people who did not value their humanity. In this next segment, Dr. Ann Lundy performs and shares the importance of Black sacred music. Here's Dr. Lundy.
That was one of the African-American spirituals, Soon I Will Be Done with the Troubles of the World. Troubles of the World, Troubles of the World. Soon I will be done with the troubles of the world, going home to live with God. As we think about Juneteenth and the trials of our many African-American ancestors, expressed through music. As a musician, I really enjoy playing some of those songs. I'm not a vocalist, I'm an instrumentalist, but I love playing some of those songs, and I'm hoping that it will remind people of the importance that music has in the human experience. It's always, no matter where you go on this planet, I'm sure you can find somebody somewhere expressing music in some way or another. So as we remember Juneteenth, this is just one of the songs of the enslaved people that were singing about how throughout the trials and tribulations that they were dealing with in slavery, that their connection was to God, and these spirituals were reminding us that, you know, soon I will be done, the trials and tribulations will be over. That was one of the spirituals from way past when. There is a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul. There's a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. So again, as we think about Juneteenth and the importance that music and specifically spirituals play in the African-American community, that's one of my favorites. I know there are many, many, many others. But I guess it kind of reminds me of my grandma and the way she used to make me feel that even when things were not going on, there's a balm, there's something that could help you get through these tough times. And I think sometimes with these times we're dealing with, that there's a balm for everybody, and somehow we will get through this. I wanted to play another song. This is called No More Auction Blocks for Me. My understanding is that it's a song came about right after slavery was, in theory, abolished. Of course, there are many discussions about was it really abolished. But anyway, this is a song that the words are saying, no more auction blocks for me. No more, no more, no more auction blocks for me. Many thousand gone. No more whips and chains for me. No more, no more. No more masses voice for me. Many thousand gone. So again, it's one of those songs where, as my enslaved ancestors were beginning to get some degree of humanity back into their lives, they were remembering, though, that these horrors that my ancestors endured during the time of slavery, they were saying, you know, this is over. We can't have this anymore. Many thousand gone. And they're remembering their ancestors. So I like to play this one for you, too. You've just heard live music and a discussion about African-American freedom songs and Black sacred texts with my guest, Dr. Ann Lundy. She's the musical director of the Community Music Center of Houston.
Get 'em in, get 'em in. That sun is hot and plenty bright. Let's get on to business and get home tonight. Get 'em in. Auctioning slaves is a real high art. Bring that young gal, Roy, she's good for a start. Get 'em in, get 'em in. Now here's a real goodbye on about 15. Her great-grandmammy was a die-homey queen. Just look at her face, she sure ain't homely. Like Sheba in the Bible, she's black but comely. Bid 'em in. Gonna start at 3. Can I hear 3? Step up, gents, take a good look, see. Cause I know you'll want her once you've seen her. She's young and ripe, make a darn good breeder. Bid 'em in. She's good in the field, she can sew and cook. Strip her down, Roy, let the gentleman look. She's full up front and ample behind. Examine her teeth if you got a mind. Bid 'em in, get 'em in. Here's a bid of 3 from a man who's thrifty. 325, can I hear 350? Your money ain't earning you much in the banks. Turn around, Roy, let them look at her flanks. Bid 'em in. 350's bidding, I'm looking for 4. At $400, she's a bargain, sure. 4 is the bid, 450. 5, $500, now look alive. Bid 'em in, get 'em in. Don't mind them tears, that's one of her tricks. 550's bidding, who'll say 6? She's healthy and strong and well-equipped. Make a fine lady's maid when she's properly whipped. Bid 'em in. 6, 650, don't be slow. 7 is the bid, gonna let her go. At 7 she's going, going, gone. Pull her down, Roy, bring the next one on. Bid 'em in, get 'em in, bid 'em in.
That was poet and vocalist Oscar Brown Jr. What is democracy? Musician and activist Fela Amigalapo Kuti, who pioneered Afrobeat music along with Sandra Isidore, was repeatedly arrested and beaten for writing lyrics that expose corporate corruption, abusive governments and military, as well as neglectful NGOs doing business on the continent of Africa. Here's Fela.
Now, I mentioned democracy. Now, in English, an Englishman will say democracy. But if the African man wants to say it in broken, he will say democracy. You see now. I never thought of the word. I said democracy. That's now I saw craziness. I said I could not see let my people see that democracy really is not that word, that is really madness, you know. So I said, now I started to sing. I start to think of this word democracy. Democracy. Crazy demo. Demonstration of grace. Crazy demonstration. Poor man they cry. Rich man they mess. Democracy. Crazy demo. Demonstration of grace.
What is going through your mind in that photograph? You do not give an inch. You are just looking that man right in the eye. And when you watch the whole video, he is screaming in your face hateful things. What's going through your mind? Why did you hold your gaze? Tell us about that.
Not much went through my head except the words that my father, who passed away 16 years ago, used to tell my brothers and his children. He just raised us to always, no matter what, no matter who the threat is, no matter what the threat is, that you look them in the eye so that they know that you're human.
We must learn our history. We must teach.
Stop the black family.
Teach the young.
We
black body to exist in America means that it is in a constant state of rebellion. A never-ending song of proving that my body is worthy of existing in a place that my ancestors built. What makes my body disposable? What makes it worthy of your lies buried under the pretense of freedom? What makes it so unholy that not even God himself can protect it from you? How is it possible for my body to be powerful and powerless at the very same time? Why am I at war for my very right to exist? Why am I in a battle for the rights to my body, to reclaim my black body? What would the world look like if black lives really matter? What makes it so unholy that not even God himself can protect it from you? How is it possible for my body to be powerful and powerless at the very same time? Why am I at war for my very right to exist? Why am I in a battle for the rights to my body, to reclaim my black body? What would the world look like if black lives really mattered?
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
You're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt.
Today, I have a special guest with me, and I am excited. This is Juneteenth. Juneteenth holiday that's celebrated throughout the country. And Mr. Sam Collins is with us today. He has been a cultural caretaker, and he has preserved many of the stories about Juneteenth because he's had a family member who painstakingly recorded history from the early 1900s up until his transition. We're going to talk about that, as well as the historical significance of Juneteenth. Sam Collins is with the National Board for Historic Trusts. And again, he is known throughout the island of Galveston and the state of Texas and the country as one of the leading voices on Juneteenth. Welcome, Sam, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation. And it is the National Trust for Historic Preservation. One of the advisors for the state of Texas. So they have several. I'm the longest serving board member representing Texas at about 13 years. So I've been involved for a while, and the National Trust has a program, hashtag tell the full history, and we're working to tell that history now.
All right. Well, speaking of that history, what is your personal story about your family and your family's involvement with Juneteenth?
Yeah, when you spoke about the ancestor, that was actually my great-grandmother that we interviewed. Surprisingly, her name was Clyde Cliff Taylor. So when people hear the name Clyde, they think of a male, but she was actually a female born in San Felipe, or in Sealy in the San Felipe area, Austin County, in 1907. And we started interviewing her at 97 in 2004, 100, 101, 102, 103. But more to the story, growing up in the 70s and the 80s, I attended Juneteenth activities in Galveston County, whether that was activities in Galveston, Texas City, Hitchcock. The celebrations in our area are not just one single day, but often a couple of weeks long with pageants and other activities. So this Juneteenth holiday is important for so many reasons, but mainly I tell individuals Juneteenth represents a day that our country moved towards a more perfect union. We were not perfect in 1865, nor are we even perfect today, but it represents a day on the calendar that the former enslaved individuals chose for themselves to celebrate the message of freedom. So there's great debate about the passing of the 13th Amendment in December, and when did we actually receive our freedom legally. Of course, the law was not passed. The 13th Amendment was not added until December of 1865. And some even argue that slavery just evolved, but didn't really bring us the absolute equality that is written into General Order Number 3 that Gordon Granger issued in Galveston. When you look up the definition of absolute and the definition of equality, we can see that that was not achieved in 1865 or even today, but it was progress because those individuals that were formerly enslaved began to build their community, open businesses, hold elected offices, establish communities with churches, homes, schools. One of those little known individuals is Richard Nelson, who happened to be a judge during Reconstruction time. He owned his own newspaper, was a postmaster, registered to vote June 14, 1867, got married on March 19, 1868, gave one of the best speeches that I have ever read on Juneteenth, 1871. So I would encourage individuals to look that information up. Richard Nelson, June 19, 1871. You can read his entire speech online.
And little is known about the business people in Galveston after Juneteenth. And it was a thriving island. And many of the African Americans on the island had businesses, as you mentioned. Can you tell us about some of the institutions and businesses that were thriving during that era?
Well, one of the things Galveston is known for is the first black high school in the state of Texas. Central High School was established in 1885. Another prominent figure on the island, Norris Wright Cuny, was living during that time, and he was one of the top politicians, not only in the state, but in the nation. We have other historical figures like Jack Johnson, that was born in 1878, March 31st. You have Jesse McGuire Dent, who was one of the founding members of Delta Sigma Theta. So Galveston has a very rich history of these individuals that were our real life superheroes. I talk about the movie Black Panther sometime and the fact that Hollywood has created a fake hero from a fake place called Wakanda. And I love the movie. I'm not trying to take away from the excellence that was portrayed on the screen, but we have real people from real places that we need to celebrate. And Galveston Island, Houston, Texas, and other places around the settlement community in Texas City, 1867 settlement. All of these communities had individuals that were heroes. When I talk about my great grandmother, while there may not be a bridge or a building named after her, she was truly a superhero because she is the foundation on which I stand to do all of the work that I do.
All right, you're listening to Sam Collins. I'm Nicole Holt, and talk to us more about the origins of Juneteenth. I understand there was a colored troops at that time who helped.
Absolutely. Too often we focus only on Gordon Granger and him coming into Galveston issuing General Order Number 3. There were actually five general orders issued on that day. But along with him were hundreds, if not thousands, of United States colored troops. And one of my maternal grandmother's friends tells the story that her grandfather told her it was not the piece of paper, but the men with the guns that brought the message of freedom. Too often we focus on the monument at Ashton Villa or the historical marker on 22nd and Strand that tells the story of Juneteenth. But we forget to tell that there were men fighting for their own freedom, fighting for the freedom of their wives, children, family, friends. they took up arms and were not waiting for somebody to rescue them. They showed up on those ships and boats at the time coming into Galveston's dock at Pier 21. And when they got off those ships in uniform with weapons, the locals and the rebels and the individuals there understood that they were there for business, and they meant to enforce the law that now the enslaved people were free. And they did just that.
That's a piece of history that's incredible that we don't get to hear often, or not at all.
Yeah, too often the story of our individuals that stood up and fought, and these shining examples of courage within the Black or African-American community, is not celebrated. We hear the stories of enslavement and the abuse and the torture, but we do not hear the stories that there were people revolting and fighting back. We need not be ashamed of our ancestors because something happened to them with enslavement. They did fight back. You don't hear about the revolts in the story. They did take up arms. There was no north route to freedom with the Underground Railroad. Many of our ancestors that were here that did run ran to Mexico. So that's a history and a story that we don't hear about. But these men and women took up arms and they resisted the bondage that they were placed in. So hold your heads high and know that your ancestors and the strength of their DNA runs through your veins. So be strong.
I would love to have you on to talk about Jack Johnson exclusively. Perhaps we can revisit that conversation. In this pivotal historical moment with a call for change and social justice, what's your vision to extend Juneteenth beyond a day of celebration?
Well, right now we have a national campaign to make Juneteenth a national holiday. And with that, what it does, it puts on the calendar another day of celebration for freedom and liberty. And with that, we can then expand our history. It's 365 days. Our history predates the forming of America as a country on these shores. And we need to teach that history. We need to tell the full story of those that came before Columbus and those that were on these shores, and also the story of the explorer Estevanico, who was the first non-native enslaved individual to arrive in Galveston. Definitely need to teach that history.
You've been listening to Sam Collins, and we are learning some extraordinary information about Juneteenth. I'm Akua Holt. Let's close by, telling us how we can stay connected to your organization.
I do have a website if you want to keep up with me, www.truthstrong.org. That's www.truthstrong.org. And we're inspired by the true stories that give us our strength.
All right, Sam Collins, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Akua.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Thank you for listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Although Africa has not been impacted to the extent and degree of most of the Western world, French doctors called to test trials in Africa first, notwithstanding, as the director of WHO, General Dr. Tedros Adhanom, encourages us to proceed in the spirit of Ubuntu.
Hello, Africa. Hello, my continent. I'm delighted to be part of In for Africa Festival to mobilize support for our continent's response to COVID-19. So far, Africa has not been hit as hard by the virus as some other parts of the world. But we must not be complacent. The number of new cases is still increasing in many countries on our continent. I want to thank President Ramaphosa and Chairperson Faki for their leadership in this critical time. The Continental Strategy for Africa and the coalition of political and business leaders have positioned Africa well. To make the Continental Strategy effective, each and every African has a part to play in keeping themselves and each other safe. You can be a role model in your community by cleaning your hands, covering your cough, keeping a safe distance from others, and following the advice of your local health authorities. Make sure you only share information from sources you trust. Beware of rumors. They can be more deadly than the virus. The World Health Organization is committed to working with all African people to defeat this virus and to make sure that the health for all is not a slogan, but a reality for every African. In the spirit of Ubuntu and humanity, your success is our success, and your health is our health. The virus has changed our lives, but it must bring us together in unity and solidarity. WHO is proud to say we're all in for Africa. Enjoy the music and stay safe.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
I'm Akeem Browder. My brother Khalif died after spending 3 years on Rikers Island because we couldn't afford bail and because the system thought he was disposable. Right now, Rikers Island has the highest coronavirus infection rate in the world, and it's spreading like wildfire in the prisons and immigration detention centers. These are our brothers, our aunts, our families, and our neighbors, and none of them are disposable. We have to free them all.
Rise up, neighbors! Close all the camps and jails no more. Oh no, let my people go.
Our children safe in loving arms.
Let my people go.
Now part the seas, now right the wrongs. Let my people go.
Rise up, neighbors! Close all the gaps and jails no more. Oh no, let my people go.
Oh no,
let
the walls, let my people go.
No more
COVID, Race, and Democracy, Fahima Sek of WPFW, Washington, D.C., and Dr. Janaka Lagoke, Assistant Professor of History and Pan-African Studies at Lincoln University, talks about the UN resolution that was drafted by African leaders who have called for an investigation of the United States for human rights violations against African Americans. Here's Dr. Lagoke.
In the wake of the killing of George Floyd, Africans, leaders and grassroots movements and leaders of opinion, they have sympathized with Black Americans. And then in an expression of support, you know, to their cause, and as you know, we live the same experience. So I just want to focus on one particular initiative, that of African leaders, and under the leadership of Burkina Faso, they drafted a document, and you know, to ask the United Nations, you know, to organize a debate on police brutality and racism in the United States. And this is a bold step. I think this is the first time that such an initiative is taken by African leaders. And so for that kind of initiative, only the support of one country is sufficient for the UN, you know, to welcome, you know, the petition. But in this case, all 54 African countries are supported and drafted and signed it. And so, you know, that's something we need to watch. And then the debate can happen anytime. It can happen anytime.
Now, this particular manifestation of the protest is very different from anything we've ever seen. The lynching of George Floyd is not the first time that a Black man has been murdered by the police. What do you think is different about this time?
Oh, I think that there are several elements. We, you know, may not have time to mention them all, but we are in a particular year, 2020, and then the COVID-19 is hurting our people, and then hundreds of thousands of people have lost their lives. And then the entire world is living under a particular anxiety. In the United States, 40 million people have lost their jobs. And in that context, we saw that there was some other debates or conversations. For instance, there was a conversation about Africans who feared that they were going to be taken as guinea pigs, you know, by the West. And there was an expression of discrimination against Africans in China. And we saw how the World Health Organization and many people in the West refused to accept the COVID organics, you know, the cure that was invented by Madagascar. So with all those things put together, when we saw that George Floyd was killed by a white police officer who put his hands in his pockets and then who did not care to be filmed. So that arrogance, I think, revolted many people in the United States and across the globe. And that's why George Floyd killing is particularly different. And also because when George Floyd was dying, he was calling on his mother, and I think that this particularly touched everyone's, and that's why the reaction was different this time.
Now, we are in the midst of a pandemic, and that notwithstanding, people globally were willing to take to the streets to cry for justice. What do you think has enabled folks to risk safety in an effort to go out and cry for justice or demand justice?
Yeah, so and also when the way the leaders of the world, you know, took some decisions in the attempt, to fight against the COVID-19. They took some hasty decisions. They did not prepare, the population, and they knew that when people are confined like that, women are going to be abused, and then this increased like domestic violence against women. And then, as I said, many people were losing their jobs. So all those ingredients are put together caused an uproar and a popular revolt. Now, Black Lives Matter, of course, is a movement that started in the United States. As you know, Black people are all over the world, and then they are living under the same conditions, and they are suffering from the same system, that they're suffering from that systemic racism, and then they're suffering from white supremacy, and then they've been exploited, by the same thing. So, and then also, people were tired to see Black people being killed like that in the United States over and over. And then people have experienced the same thing in France. They experienced the same thing in England. There were some revolts a couple of years ago in France, some other years ago in England. So that same experience, brought people together. And when they saw the specter of that police brutality that reminded to Blacks, the lynching that people experienced in the United States, that reminded them of, the killing of the leaders of Africans in Africa. So I think it was sufficient for them to revolt in a context of a revolutionary movement. And that's why that movement was became globalized, thanks also to the social media, because people could see live, if I can use an expression, the killing of George Floyd. People were sharing information. Information was circulating faster, and then of course it was sufficient for people to organize.
Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Legoke, for joining us for the Pacifica COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Fahima Sack. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Akua Holt. You're listening to a special Juneteenth edition of COVID Race and Democracy. Gloria Rubeck has been a revolutionary activist for over half a century, starting in the 1960s by supporting the civil rights movement and opposing the war in Vietnam. After moving to Houston in 1968, she helped to get signatures and petitions to get a Pacifica radio station here. At 42 years old, Ruben Gutierrez was scheduled for execution by lethal injection at Texas State Penitentiary in Huntsville on Tuesday. He received a stay by the U.S. Supreme Court. After fighting for over 25 years, the Texas death penalty abolition movement was there to protest and bear witness. Gloria is a contributing editor for the Workers' World newspaper and is organizing the reestablishment of Prisoners Solidarity Committee.
Reporting from the death penalty capital of the United States, Texas. Last night, Ruben Gutierrez, who has been on death row over 20 years and always proclaimed his innocence, was scheduled for execution at 6 o'clock. I pulled into the parking lot across from the death house in Huntsville last night at 5 o'clock, and one of my friends rushed up and she's, "Gloria, we gotta stay." And I'm like, "Don't kid with me now, this isn't funny." She's, "No, I'm serious." So what we did was his mom, two aunts, his wife, his brother, and other family friends were there, as well as activists who had come from Houston. So we had a little impromptu rally there. I had made signs for the protest with Ruben's photo on them, so we were all holding signs and taking turns talking about him. But the facts of his case are alarming, actually, because There's several things that were pending before the Supreme Court, and it was the U.S. Supreme Court that granted the stay an hour before the execution. So there was the whole issue of test the DNA. What are y'all afraid of? The second issue was Ruben is a devout Catholic, and he wanted a Catholic priest, or at least a Christian minister, to be with him as they killed him. Well, last summer, I guess it was, a man named Patrick Murphy was scheduled to be executed. That, thank heavens, there was a stay of execution. Texas executed a person in January and a person in February, but since then, because of the pandemic, they've stopped. But there's another one scheduled in 2 weeks, on July, like the first week of July. So the Texas death penalty abolition movement and other activists are going to be preparing to protest Billy Wardlow's execution that'll coming up. And in the meantime, thank heavens that Ruben Gutierrez was taken back to death row alive. And we'll see what happens with his appeal. This is Gloria Ruback with the Texas death penalty abolition movement, based at the Shape Community Center in Houston, Texas, signing off, and we will keep you informed about what happens with the next execution scheduled.
This concludes our special Juneteenth edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations, staff, volunteers, and radio affiliates. Special thanks to each of our volunteers, the Pacifica COVID Task Force, and you, the listeners. Remember, there is a second wave of the coronavirus. Be mindful and stop the spread.
I leave you with a quote by Ibram Kendi, author of How to Be an Anti-Racist. Changing minds is not a movement. Critiquing racism is not activism. Changing minds is not activism. An activist produces power and policy change, not mental change. Thank you for listening.
This has been COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily broadcast by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates, produced by a group of committed men and women volunteers willing to make a difference. If you tuned in late, you can listen and download the show from our YouTube channel, Pacifica Foundation TV, or from the website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Tell a friend about it. It will be worth it.